My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is The Two Matts for the week ending Friday the 12th of April, brought to you by the New European Newspaper. And this is a place for people who think without borders, it says here. What did we talk about?
Well, we talked about the CAS review into the whole question of gender transition.
Yeah, and we had a very vigorous debate about
it. Yeah, we did, and I hope one that people find interesting. And then we got to talk about the Amy Winehouse movie and the Prince Andrew interview, Emily Maitlis
Scoop on Netflix. Yeah.
So lots of hot topics this
Very
week.
Hot topics. And yeah, I think it's probably safe to say we can expect some flack on Twitter, but we don't care because we believe in free speech and discussion, and we believe things get better when you talk about them.
To quote the great Charlie Sheen, bring it.
So this is The Two Matts, episode 40. Enjoy. So, Matt, big week this week for...
Yes, big domestic story was the final version of the CAS review into in what's called GIDS, the Gender Identity and Development Service at the Tavistock Centre, which was done by Dr. Hilary Cass, a very distinguished figure who used to be the president of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. And I think to get a flavour of kind of the intensity of the story, it might be worth having a blast of Hannah Barnes, who, when she was at Newsnight with Deborah Cohen, was one of the journalists who led the investigation. She's now actually at the New Statesman, but here she is on Monday night's Newsnight talking about her reaction to the final CAS review.
Yes, this programme and some other notable exceptions in the media have spoken up, the Times, the Sunday Times, but really, where has everybody been? Where has NHS England been all these years? Where's the oversight been? Why allow an unevidenced or poorly evidenced-based powerful drug to be rolled out without demanding robust data to support that? Where have the politicians been? Where's the regulator been? It took our report on Newsnight for the CQC, the Care Quality Commission, to go back to GIDS and inspect them, and that inspection rated them inadequate. And as I say, where have large swathes of the media been? And sadly, I include the BBC and that outside of this programme.
Wow. So, you know, it's quite an indictment and it's...
Just for people who aren't
one thing about Hannah, which is just worth mentioning, is that her book, Time to Think, which came out in 2023, is kind of the most forensic and compelling journalistic book on what happened at GIDS. Yeah. And it's just worth mentioning that it was turned down by 22 publishers.
Wow.
Which kind of illustrates...
Wow.
Her point.
And this is something we're going to talk about the debate as much as the topic itself.
I think so, yeah.
It's really a story of our times, isn't it?
I think it's a story of craven behaviour by media and by institutions and publishing and so on.
And toxic self-interest in parts as well, which we can come on to.
Yes, and where that toxicity lies, I think we can also talk about. But let's
dig into specifics a bit more.
Give
the listeners some sense of context.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing to say is it's an extraordinary piece of work. It's 388 pages long, and I have read it all, and it is a remarkable piece of very calm and measured and evidence-informed, as far as evidence has been collected, which we'll come on to, representations by a clinician. Cass is not a politician or a journalist. She's a clinician, and her job was to see what went wrong at JIDS, and I guess more importantly, what can be done correctly. It's been a 4-year gig. It was announced in September 2020, a while back, by NHS England that she was going to do this. And the reason was that, two things really that this happened was that there'd been a surge in referrals, a huge surge. In 2011-12, there were 250 referrals of young people to JIDS. In 2021-22, there were more than 5,000.
Again, for clarity, these are referrals of children who say, I feel like I was born in the wrong gender.
Yes, I mean,
and I want to start undergoing treatment to take me to another gender.
They're experiencing what is variously called gender confusion, gender dysphoria, gender incongruence. And let us say at the outset, because it's really important, that it can be an extremely unpleasant thing to go through. And Cass is motivated throughout her report by a desire to make it easier for people. So there was that surge of referrals, which was odd. And one argument was, it's become more socially acceptable to be trans or non-binary. And Cass, in a very detailed way, knocks that down and says, no, the level of the surge cannot simply be explained by a more liberal society.
Not in that condensed period,
exactly. And the second factor was that a growing number of whistleblowers at JIDS in various contexts were sending out some very alarming signals about the inclination by clinicians at JIDS to rush kids onto medical pathways, and a fear that ideology was trumping science. So that was the background.
Yeah.
Particularly with regard to puberty blockers, which are a medication which are given to children in order to, it was alleged, give them time to think, to pause puberty and give them a chance to think. Now, we can get onto puberty blockers in more detail, but what Cass devotes a lot of attention to was that there was very little information and data about the safety, the effectiveness of puberty blockers, but they became the norm, often after only a couple of sessions.
Yeah.
And crucially, they weren't being given to kids, it turned out, just to give them time to think, because 90% plus of kids then went on to the hard stuff, which is hormone treatment.
Proper transition.
Major bodily changes with consequences that are only now really becoming clear. It's important to emphasize some people are happy with the medical route, but what's emerging from research, as it is now finally done, is that there are serious side effects, both with puberty blockers and hormone treatments. Yeah. And
the side effects I've read about includes, stuff as fundamental as bone weakness,
an inability to have an orgasm, mental health, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And the worst revelation, I think, this was a revelation in the review, was that in the course of conducting the review, she had asked the adult clinics, of which there are, I think, 7, to give her help with, how had the 9,000 people who'd been through JIDS got on.
Yeah.
And with one exception, they all refused to cooperate.
This is astonishing, isn't it?
I mean, I think it's scandalous. I think it puts this into the same level of national civic scandal. Of course, it's different in scale, different in nature, but as the postmaster scandal. And I think it should be treated as such. And yeah. I think the review should be the start of an audit, not the end.
Well, there's been a compulsion now, hasn't there, to reveal what's happened to
yes.
these 9,000
yes.
people.
Yes, and that's the start. But I suppose what may amaze listeners is she comes up with a bunch of recommendations, very sensible. But what I think might astonish people is that they're new ideas. So yeah. she says, maybe young people aged 17 to 25 should have a follow-through service, you know, just to check they're okay. Maybe the different bits of the system should train and collaborate together. Maybe there should be clinically based research for everything.
Yeah.
Maybe there should be provision for those who wish to detransition. You know, maybe the administration of pharmaceuticals to young people should be unhurried. She says, you know, before the age of 25, when the brain stops developing, proceed with care. Mm. You know, maybe, well, actually, she's definite about this. Children should be assessed, she uses the word holistically.
Yeah.
You know, because she, and this was very well known, it has been known for almost 20 years. The children who are presenting very often suffered from, autism
yeah.
or eating disorders
yeah.
and or child abuse. So it was, to put it mildly, indelicate to yeah. assume that just putting them on puberty blockers would solve all those problems, or yeah. indeed that their gender dysphoria was permanent.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It in many cases, it was, a lot of cases, people just turned out to be gay or lesbian.
Yeah.
Or the gender dysphoria went away.
Or let's just put it bluntly, because I can remember being that age and I was confused about everything.
Yes.
You know, I wouldn't want to, I mean, I don't want to belittle anything that people are going through.
No.
But it's not, at that age, to say I am now certain about this and the consequences I'm going to be happy to live with for the rest of my life, at that age, just seems to be, let's put it as gently as you could possibly say it. It should be treated with caution.
Of course. Know? And it is unique, to my knowledge, in clinical practice where the patient diagnoses themselves.
Yeah. This is worth digging into a bit more, isn't it? Because previously there had been processes
yes.
and regulations and a regimen for people
yes.
to go through this. But it was you had to go through analysis and you had to conform to what...
And live for... Yeah.
And live for 2 years.
Yes.
And say, no, I am determined that this is the right pathway for me. The pressure from trans activists became intense around saying, well, who is anybody to tell this child what they're feeling? It's up to the child.
Yes.
And so now you have a situation where someone can walk in and say, this is how I feel, and I'm convinced of it, and I'm going to live with this for the rest of my life. Now crack on and put me on the program.
Yes.
And anybody saying, well, no, this we can't be that hasty, was suddenly under this huge
yes,
torrent
and,
of
and often
toxicity.
Their livelihood was in danger.
Yeah,
not,
well,
you know,
multiple
and their
cases,
reputation.
You know.
So I think that's right. And I think that this was, one must always examine language, I think, in these delicate cases. And this was described as affirmative therapy. Well, that sounds great. I mean, who doesn't like to be affirmed and affirmation? Mm. But, you know, we don't use affirmative therapy when we're dealing with kids with eating disorders.
No.
You know, we don't take someone with suicidal
yeah.
ideation and
say, well, here's how to kill yourself then.
Of course
yeah.
not. Yeah. And, I mean, actually, you only have to say it out loud to realise what a nonsense it makes of,
yeah.
of every principle of clinical practice.
Yeah.
I mean, what happened, we're recording this on Thursday, the report actually came out in full late on Tuesday night / Wednesday morning. And Wednesday was a lot of sober reflection upon the review, but also a bit of a group hug. Like, there was a lot of memory holing by people who actually were either complicit in what Cass has revealed in full, or conspicuously silent.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this is a really big public scandal.
Yeah.
And it's an example of how, it's difficult to, there aren't any analogues really that completely fit, but in the way that religion corrupts the abortion debate, especially in America, less so here, in this country, ideology has corrupted gender treatment and science. And, you know, it's really important that progressives in particular, I think, grow up and own their mistakes. I mean, I was looking back at the stuff I wrote about trans and so on, and I, you know, I'm ashamed to say, you know, but in 2017, I still hadn't got it. I was still triangulating.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean was I was buying that sort of liberal inclination to think that the answer invariably lies in splitting the difference. There is a, I'm sure that it'll be all right, you know, very kumbaya-ish. And it wasn't really till 2018-19 that I sort of the penny dropped.
Yeah.
And that was only really through talking to some of the people who were who've been the real, you know, stars of this. A group of very brave women, you know, people like Maya Forstater, Helen Joyce, Julie Bindle, Kathleen Stocks, Suzanne Moore, Janice Turner, Alison Bailey. I mean, I could go on. Hannah Barnes, Deborah Cohen, Hadley Freeman, Sarah Dittum, Sonia Soda, J.K. Rowling, of course, Susanna Rustin, and many others. And I apologise for leaving. I mean, you know, they were really having lumps kicked out of them on social media, and in many cases in life, and actually in some cases in reality. You know, some of them were subject to physical attack, and I think that it's very important that we don't see this as a victimless crime, because there's an intent, you know, this is a tiny group part of the population, the trans population. But actually, this is the clinical side of a debate that affects 51% of the population, which is biological women. And my feeling is that, and I wrote this in the New European this week about the hate speech laws, is that in all probability, there'll be a Labour government by the end of the year. And it's time for progressives to really start owning their mistakes and getting ready for the difficult business of being in power. Because, let's be honest, you know, during Brexit and when Trump was elected, we made a big deal of being defenders of the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, we said, look, that 350 million on the side of a bus, that's a lie.
Yeah.
You know, and Trump's lies aren't without number, and we've rightly attacked, you know, the pseudoscience of climate denialism.
Yeah.
You know, but if we're going to embrace truth, we have to also embrace the truth that requires courage to express.
Yeah.
And what happened here was that the trans campaigners, I think, spotted brilliantly. I mean, with strategic brilliance, that they could use social media as a sort of electrified fence around certain issues. So no debate was one for hashtag no debate. Another was hashtag trans women are women, which of course, initially you think, yeah, of course. But what they meant was literally wholly and completely the same as biological women, which of course, and then the one that I always found most appalling was anyone who disagrees with anything we say is arguing for erasure against the existence of trans people, is complicit in their suicidality. And, you know, this was daily stuff coming out.
The analogy that, I mean, it's probably not right, but what I felt when I was subjected as the editor-in-chief of the New European to a tiny fraction of this when we ran a cover story by Sarah Dittum.
Yeah.
Which I'd commissioned because I was really interested in the culture war around J.K. Rowling.
Yes.
And, you know, it struck me as astonishing that you had these three younger actors who had publicly turned on the woman who had made them, really, you know, J.K. Rowling.
And they're very quiet today, aren't they?
They're very quiet. And actually, I noticed that somebody on Twitter had said, you know, They owe you an apology, Emma. What's her name? Emma
Watson.
Watson and the
Daniel Radcliffe.
Daniel Radcliffe and Rupert Grint. They owe you an apology in the safe knowledge that you'll forgive them. And I think she tweeted back saying,
"Not so safe."
Actually, yeah. You know, save. Yeah. They can save their apologies to the children who've been irreparably damaged. And what it struck me was when we ran this cover story, there was a generational element to it. So all of the people who were piling in on us, and without reading the article, because I know for a fact they hadn't read the article, they say, this is transphobic, rubbish.
You bigoted.
Know, these people are bigots. One person, Owen Jones, friend of the show, accused us literally of adopting transphobia as a business model. Because and this is where it got weird to me. Initially, I just thought, fucking idiot. But then I thought about it a little bit more. And I thought, no, you're projecting your business model on me.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, your business model is whipping up outrage and hate and collecting groups of people who will froth at the mouth and feel absolute anger at perfectly reasoned debate.
Yes.
Perfectly reasoned debate about something that's massively contentious and needs exploring and needs conversation.
Totally.
And yet your answer to it is, the minute you disagree with me, you're shut down. And the analogy I grew up Catholic. And in the Catholic Church, you're expected to believe in transubstantiation.
Right.
The literal transformation
the host is literally
of
the piece
body of bread that's in your mouth, or the glass of wine that's in your mouth, that in the chalice, literally, not metaphorically, literally becomes the body of Christ and the blood of Christ. And if you say that's bollocks, you are literally excommunicated from the Catholic Church. And it felt like that. You know, well, it felt like there is one way or the highway.
I'm not the first person to say that trans ideology often resembles a religion rather than a political campaigning position or a human rights campaign. You know, it deals in heresy.
Yeah.
It deals in vilification. It deals in purges and witch burning, metaphorically.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it does it.
Just to close off on the Owen Jones thing, because I think it's relevant. What struck me as deeply cynical from what he was suggesting, and I'll read you the tweet. It says, it might seem odd that the New European, a magazine founded to support EU membership, is nailing its mast to anti-trans rights. But it makes commercial sense. UK transphobia is concentrated amongst the affluent middle-aged centrists, which constitutes its core readership. I mean, so he's basically saying, if you voted Remain, and you're a centrist, and you reject Corbynism, then you are likely to be a transphobe.
Literally Hitler.
And this one article that they've run exploring this culture war has made them, is nailing our colours to the transphobic.
Well, if you want to play Owen's game of follow the money, I'll go you one better, right? Yeah. Which is one of the reasons that the Tavistock Trust let JIDS get on with it was because money follows patients. It was getting so much money from these people coming through the clinic, right?
Right.
Number two, The Guardian, which, you know, let's say drove out Suzanne Moore and Hadley Freeman, who were both gender critical feminists, depends hugely on its advertising revenue in the States, where people who read The Guardian are very, very, very hostile to what they regard as, they call it transphobia, gender critical. Number three, Stonewall, which after marriage equality was brilliantly passed as legislation, hooray, found itself in need of a new institutional mission, started to focus on trans and offered big commercial packages to businesses, offering ambassadors to come in and, you know, sort people's attitude out. There was a business model here.
Yeah.
Now, the existence of the business model doesn't mean that position A or position B is right, but if we're being invited to talk about the commercial realities about it, that's the commercial reality.
I read this stuff and I thought, is this really how these people think? Because there's a certain insanity to that level of projection where they've come, you know, here's a newspaper that's meant to be about the discussion of ideas, discussing ideas. And people should read Sarah's piece. It's not...
reasonable piece.
I mean, actually, honestly, when I read it, I thought, well, she's trod carefully where she needed to. You know, she wasn't going absolutely gung-ho, like nailing her colours to any mast, right? It was a very measured piece, I thought. But the response to it just felt opportunistic and cynical, and not about my business model, but their business model.
Yes.
You know, about the whipping up of hate for attention and ultimately revenue of some sort.
100%. And I think, you know, the toxicity on both sides, triangulation, which is now gaining currency. Be careful, because look, there's always fault on both sides in any argument this big and this intense. But, you know, did balaclava-wearing feminists turn up at trans activist rallies and beat up activists? No. Did a single transactivist lose their livelihood during this debate? No. SNP politicians stood smiling in front of placards saying decapitate TERFs. That's trans exclusionary radical feminists.
Yeah.
Is there an equivalent on the other side?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You know, there was a case in 2017 where a 61-year-old woman was, Maria McLaughlin, I think she was called, was beaten up at Hyde Park Corner. She was a feminist, gender-critical feminist, by a trans activist in a balaclava who identifies as a woman but has the body of a man,
yeah,
and was convicted. But interestingly, the judge forced the victim to address the perpetrator by her pronouns.
No way.
Yeah, in court. So, you know, if there has been toxicity, and there has, it has been heavily slanted on one side. And I think, you know, we need to own that and acknowledge that and just say it out loud. And there's one of my favourite stand-up comedians is Bill Burr. And one of his favourite lines is, why has it gone so quiet? You know, and the problem is that this makes liberals and progressives feel nervous because they've fallen into the trap of thinking that all progressive movements are the same and that all change is progress, which is even worse. And it isn't progress to force male-bodied individuals into women's self single-sex spaces and onto girls' sports teams. It isn't. Mm. You know, that's not true.
Yeah.
And also, you know, this argument that it's just the same as the gay rights movement. It isn't.
Yeah.
Because all that gay people and lesbians were asking for was equality with straight people. You know, no one lost anything by having marriage equality introduced. It was a wonderful reform. But the fact is, and the trans lobby will not accept this,
yeah,
but it is the case that if you transition from male to female, you deserve dignity and respect. But there are issues about people who are still biologically male going into single-sex spaces, female sport,
sure,
you know,
yeah,
rape refuges.
And we're seeing that come down a bit.
It's not transphobic to say that.
No. This is the thing. And, you know, it would benefit us all if we could all just have an open conversation about this without being shut down.
And we could have a long while ago.
We could have this conversation anytime you like. But today I still see them on Twitter closing things down, belittling the CAST report. You know,
yes,
pinpicking little.
Yes.
Oh, this is. Well, I'm really going to believe in the whole report because they've suggested this thing, and I don't believe in that little thing. You know, I mean, little kind of pedantic stuff that is meant to undermine and erode the value of something that, as you said right at the beginning, is by a clinician, a pediatrician, somebody who wants good outcomes for these children, right? This is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Now, what we've got is a bunch of people on either side, maybe you could say, you know, let's sit in the middle of it. You've got a bunch of people who are ideologically at war. And what gets forgotten is there are a bunch of children in the middle of this, and some of whom have been, without a shadow of a doubt, irreparably damaged.
Yes.
In the process.
But I don't think it's J.K. Rowling's fault.
No, I don't either.
And I think that the idea that, you know, the fault on both sides argument can be carried way too far.
Well, I'm not doing a Charlottetown on that.
No.
But and I don't think there are very fine people on both sides. I think there are some people who are secondary victims. I think the primary victims are these are the kids who have
totally
gone through this. The secondary victims are the people who have shouted long and hard and been vilified for trying to protect those children at the hands of people who, some of whom I'm sure are every bit as convinced of the truth of their argument as others. But the odious group of people I'd identify are those who have, for their own cachet, attached themselves to these arguments,
yes,
because they think it looks good for their brand.
Well, know? I think what happened was that a series of important social justice movements emerged in the 2010s, especially after the murder of George Floyd, but also the Me Too movement and Extinction Rebellion and so on, and Just Stop Oil. And these were all, and these are and were really important. And the trans issue got sort of lobbed in with this,
yeah,
as if it was the same.
Yeah.
And not all these issues are the same. I mean, no, you know, the answer to climate change is obviously not the same as stopping policemen murdering people of colour. You know, they all have different strands. I mean, so
but the social movements that underpin them have the same tactics and the same resolutions.
Right, and what I think, you know, to sort of circle back to where we started, you know, the fact remains that 5,000 people, young people, who are unquestionably going through, you know, considerable suffering and worry and anxiety are now on waiting list. Because what is the net result of all this, other than all the sort of shrapnel that's been sprayed around, is that JIDS is being shut, has been shut down. And the government is slowly moving to regional hubs. There's going to be one in London and one in Liverpool.
Yeah.
In fact, it'll fall to the new government to implement this. But there are 5,000 kids who are getting no care at all.
Yeah.
You know, happy now? Yeah. Is that what you wanted?
Yeah.
Because, you know, in order to defend your purity and your ideological position and your belief that identity is entirely self-defined and women who express legitimate concerns about single-sex activities, spaces and so on, are all by definition bigots.
Bigots, yeah.
Because of that, we've ended up in a position where the vulnerable trans kids are stuck in limbo.
Yeah.
You know, good job.
This is what is just so awful about the debate, or the lack of debate, is this sense that, let's make it reductive. Let's say you've got people who believe that women's spaces should be sacrosanct, and that's been a long, hard fought for right, and they're going to fight for that right to persevere. And then you've got people saying, ah, but with this exception now that you must think about. And one, and that group of people saying, my belief is such that you're a bigot, but don't you dare call me a bigot for saying that you're a bigot.
Yes, exactly.
it's just circular nonsense.
So you've seen, you know, people who've been very brave, like Martina Navratilova and Sharon Davis, who have, you know, put their reputations on the line. And you see them on social media, people think horrible things about them. And all they are saying actually is, why do you think women's sport exists?
Yeah.
You know, what? Why do you think it was created?
That's right.
You know, and the answer, of course, once you pose it like that, is obvious.
Yeah. Because there's differences in speed and strength and all sorts.
And even if you do take hormones, you know, size, lung size, heart capacity, you know, all the post-puberty, really, it's game over, you know. And the examples of Riley Gaines is a very important example of this, an American swimmer who brought to attention the extraordinary way she'd been treated at the University of Pennsylvania when Leah Thomas, the trans woman, came onto the team.
Yeah.
And she's been a very, I think, brave and efficient campaigner around the States. And some of the cases she's brought to light, you know, one girl's swimming team was told by their coaches that if they didn't allow a trans girl, trans woman onto the team, that person would kill themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Ugh.
Now, that kind of pressure is, again, you know, are you happy? Is that what this was all about?
Yeah.
Because, in fact, a book I would urge everyone to read if they haven't, it's a very short book called Conundrum by Jan Morris.
Mm-hmm. About her transition.
Yes, and it's a beautiful book, and it was written, I think, in the 70s.
Well, just explain who Jan Morris is.
Jan Morris, and I'm going to be accused of dead naming now, but I can't do it in any other way, was born a man, and as James Morris.
What does dead naming mean?
Dead naming means when you use the name of someone before they've transitioned.
Okay.
Right? Now, Jan Morris didn't care about it, but people now go ballistic, right?
Right, okay.
So I've just been a transphobe.
Yeah, but if you look at is the Times newspaper supposed to go and eradicate the byline James Morris from the report of Hillary's conquest of Everest?
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, I mean, and
come on.
This book by previously James Morris, then by the time she wrote the book, Jan Morris, is an extraordinarily delicate and beautiful account of this painful but ultimately, you know, successful process that went from being considered a very virile, foreign correspondent and exploratory correspondent, you know, to becoming a woman and writing a series of brilliant travel books and so on. And it really, it's a very moving book. And the reason I always think people should read it is because it shows, actually, transsexualism has been around since time began. And none of this is necessary. You know, I do believe that there was a way of negotiating this in a way that would have, first of all, made sure that people got the treatment they needed. Secondly, disinfected clinical practice of the sort of encroachments of ideology.
Yeah.
And just made sure that people were, you know, given a chance to consider what were often huge changes to their lives. You know, I mean, surgery, we haven't discussed surgery, but surgery is really, really huge.
What is striking, is how many people who are literally uninvolved, and we can include ourselves in this, who've been brought into the argument. And I'm sitting here thinking, my God, you know, if I was a 13-year-old kid now or a 15-year-old kid and I was worried about gender dysmorphia, am I more or less likely to put my hand up and speak to my parents and say, you know, I think the answer is I'd be running a mile from it, because the whole bloody thing has become such a nightmare.
Yes, and a lot of social influencers in this field have deliberately told people who think they have gender dysphoria not to tell their parents.
That's right.
Which is a classic definition of cult.
Of grooming and
cult. You know, that is what it is. And I think, you know, it's an extraordinarily sad business. I think that there are some of the culprits still need to say at least sorry. And I think, you know, there is more redress to come.
Yeah.
But my overall feeling is, get real, everyone. You know, very shortly, probably with a big majority, the Labour Party is going to be in power. And, you know, yesterday we had Yvette Cooper and Wes Streeting saying, you know, positive things about the Cast Review. But particularly Yvette Cooper and Rachel Reeves, I've seen in interviews, you know, not written long ago, saying, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I don't want to get involved in this.
Yeah.
You know, and the extent to which Starmer kept Rosie Duffield, who's an excellent Labour MP, who happens to hold gender critical views, at bay.
Yeah. This
is very cowardly. You know, when he gets into number 10, assuming he wins, he's going to have to deal with things a lot harder than this.
Well, you know, it does, I think you're absolutely right. And it touches on the courage required to speak your mind, right? And if anybody has got an objection to people speaking their mind and asking questions and asking to understand, then the people who are refusing that are fucking idiots, I think. You know, and you can stick them all in the same basket as far as I'm concerned. But also the courage of parents. Now, Yvette Cooper's son is a noted trans activist who has disrupted meetings at university and stuff like this. There was a suspicion that, you know, part of the reason she doesn't want to go and be explicit about her views and not go down the rabbit hole is because she can sense the tension there within her own family.
Yes.
Now, that's fine, but if you can't level it out within your own family, so that you're not scared to say something public. She's a public servant. You know,
right.
She is there trying to represent people, the public, about a massively contentious issue. And if she's too scared to say what she really thinks, then I'm afraid to say I don't think she's worthy of the name.
And how are you going to handle young people's very fierce feelings on Gaza?
Yeah, right.
For example, you know.
And they all get, you know, again, the risk, like, draw this to a, I'm sure we've lost half the audience already, but the risk is that there does become this generational divide and it becomes more and more accentuated. You know, you get young people who feel that old people just don't understand them or aren't willing to understand them. You got old people, older generations, feeling that young people are unnecessarily angry and close down debates and they're too dogmatic and they don't respect experience, and all of those things will fester unless there's an open conversation.
Absolutely.
And the people on that side are shutting down the conversation, and it's got to stop.
I mean, if I just one final thought, which is, people have asked me over the years why I've written about this and why I've spoken about this, and I haven't done it that often, but I have, and I wouldn't claim any role in the fact that this seems to be moving in the right direction. I mean, that has been brave women, But the reason I kept at it, in spite of the fact that, you know, there were occasions when I could tell that people commissioning me were, you know, no one ever stopped me, but it was like, oh, do you really have to?
Yeah.
Was that every time I wrote about it, my DMs and sometimes email, work emails, filled with messages from women, not all in public life, saying thank you for doing this, mm-hmm. because we can't, because when we do it, we get death threats and rape threats, threats to our livelihood and everything. Mm. And I thought, this can't be allowed to go on.
No.
And I hope fervently that this marks at least a milestone in it not going on.
Well, I hope people talk about it more.
Talk about it
freely
and,
now.
And freely, and, you know, and if they're accused of being a transphobe, say, exactly what do you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, how have I, what have I just said that has made the lives of trans people worse?
And can't we just try and understand each other a bit more?
You know? Yes. And you know, and nice? Look, you know, it comes back to the point we often make on this podcast, which is the society in which we live is going to become more and more and more pluralist.
Yeah.
We have to be able to negotiate conflicts of rights, conflicts of positions. You know, that's the future. The future does not lie in no debate. And, you know,
The right side of history.
The right side. I mean, there is no right side of history.
Yeah.
There are just people.
Well, the point about
what they do.
You certainly don't find out which side of history you're on,
you know,
in the present moment. You
so,
know.
You know, over to you, Keir, is my final thought.
Very good. Very good. And over to a quick ad break, and then we'll be back with something much less contentious.
Well, and you say that.
Well, we'll find out. This podcast is brought to you, as ever, by the New European Newspaper, and we've got a great offer for you. Do you like the New European Newspaper, Matt?
Well, I like working for it, and I enjoy reading it, so it's a double thumbs up from me.
So you're already a subscriber. So this is
I actually am, yeah.
This is of no interest to you, because you'll feel like you're missing out,
but
it's a great offer.
I find it validating.
Okay. Well, listen, if you're not a subscriber, you really should be, because you'll be supporting fantastic independent journalism that you'll actually enjoy getting posted through your letterbox every week. And as an exclusive offer for listeners of the Two Mats podcast, we've got free signed copies of James O'Brien's hardback book, which is a brilliant book, isn't it?
Great book. The called book.
How They Broke Britain, and that's worth £20. And you can get that by subscribing for as little as £1 a week for all of our digital stuff. But if, like me, you love getting your hands on a physical newspaper every single week, you can get that delivered to your door for just an extra £1 a week. And that's a saving of around 80% on the cost of what you'd pay at the newsstand. So please do the right thing. Subscribe to The New European. Go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. And tell them we sent you.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day the world first heard about nudge theory.
Then on Tuesday, we revisit the non-fairy tale wedding of Charles and Camilla.
On Wednesday, the day the banana first came to Britain.
On Thursday, pack your bags. We're off to Butland's first holiday camp.
And on Friday, the day Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, Matt, you've been to the movies?
Well, as usual.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing you have any colour at all on your skin. You spend all of it in darkened cinema rooms.
I'm just crouching with a Pepsi Max.
What did you say? And a massive popcorn. What did you
say? No, I don't do the popcorn, actually. I went to see Back to Black.
Yeah.
Which I think, and in fact, I've included it in today's culture newsletter because although I don't think it's very good, I felt that it's become such a talking point that not to venture an opinion would be a kind of an act of cowardice. There are some good things in it. Eddie Marsden's great as Amy Winehouse's dad, Mitch. Leslie Manville's great as her nan, Cynthia. And the actress who plays Amy Winehouse is Marisa Abella, who people might know from the series Industry. She plays Yasmin in Industry. Very good actress. She wasn't a singer, and her singing of Amy Winehouse's catalogue is very impressive.
Is it? What does she sing it?
She sings it. And it is impressive.
Like Val Kilmer doing Jim Morrison in The Doors.
But better.
She did a great job.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, one has to give her a big... But she just isn't Amy Winehouse.
Ah, okay. That's a bit of a challenge.
It is. The preview I went to, Sam Taylor Wood, the director, said that, you know, Marisa Abella inhabited the role. And I thought, actually, she doesn't. I mean, Amy Winehouse is a very difficult person to cast. I wouldn't want that. I noticed a lot of her fans wanted Lady Gaga, but Lady Gaga's, you know, considerably older than... I mean, Amy Winehouse was only 27 when she died.
Amazing.
So, but what Marisa Abella doesn't get is the full, hilarious, sort of rugged snark of Amy Winehouse,
Is that not the fault of the script then?
No, I mean...
There's some magic missing, is there?
I mean, the way that the movie is framed, and I think it's not a great framing, is as the love story between her and Blake, who is played far too charmingly by the brilliant Jack O'Connell.
Right.
As a sort of, you know, slightly dodgy version of Jim Dale, okay? Yeah. You know, it's nice that there was this massive love affair that led to one of the great albums of the century so far, right? Or was it the last century? I'm just trying to think. No, it was this century. But the fact is that, you know, he and she led a life which was both mythic and horrifically sordid. And it doesn't tell that story at all. It's a love story, right?
And so it could be a bit more Sid and Nancy. Maybe.
I think so. Yeah, and I think that I just don't think that the casting was right. And I think this is, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't.
So how many, I know you don't like giving stars, but if you were to give a star rating?
I'd give it 1.5.
Oh,
I'm
no,
afraid.
Really?
That's so disappointing. And the music is great, and there's some terrific original music by Nick Cave and Warren Ellis as well.
Oh, brilliant.
So, you know, you can go and enjoy the sort of bathe in the nostalgia.
Yeah.
But it is not, we've talked about music biopics you know, strong views on these, you know, it's not the biopic that I would have hoped for such a consequential and amazing figure.
That's a shame. And did you also see, I know the answer to this, I know you have seen it, Scoop?
I did.
And what did you think of Scoop?
I enjoyed the drama, but again...
I know what you're going to say.
I don't think Gillian Anderson.
She was terrible.
Was right. As Emily Maitlis.
I can't say she... All I could hear was Margaret Bloody Thatcher.
I mean, we both know Emily, and everyone listens to her on the news agents, you know, her podcast. And I remember, you know, she's a friend, but I remember commissioning her to do Diaries at the Spectator.
Right.
She was so funny.
Yeah.
And self-deprecating.
But sharp as well, you know, there's energy in her head.
She's warm and, you know. Yeah. And the line she always used to write into the diaries was, it always started with, oh no. It was always her first line. Was, she'd wake up in the middle of the night thinking, what have I done about something, right? Yeah. You know, everything was always mistakes I've made. And, you know, and Gillian Anderson came across as this, again, it's framing, isn't it? Because we haven't said what it's about, which is about the Newsnight interview with Prince Andrew.
And it's told through the eyes of the booker, isn't it? Sam McAllister.
Sam McAllister, who is a remarkable person and did land this with persistence and it is an impressive... Yeah.
And you know, I don't want to... It's worth mentioning, there's been some really snidey reviews from people saying, oh, well, I wonder whether Sam McAllister will feature so prominently when the official... theatrical version of this comes out, which I think Emily's
executive producer.
Now, Sam McAllister, clearly, I know that 90% of landing scoops like this is the person who's got that contact. And so as far as I'm concerned, Sam McAllister is the hero of the story. Well, but Emily did the most brilliant interview.
It's a two-part story in a way, which is, you know, one of the most extraordinary acts of journalistic kind of persistence that Sam McAllister did by, you know, persuading Amanda Thirsk, who was Prince Andrew's long-suffering private secretary.
Is she still with him?
No.
Played
by Keely Hawes. You know, there had to be, with the Jeffrey Epstein revelations, there had to be a moment where he came out and cleared the air, which of course he didn't, and it was a disaster. Yeah. But, you know, hats off. I mean, that really was. I mean, talk about that. It's got the right name, Scoop.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's played by Billy Piper very well. And by the way, Rufus Sewell as Prince Andrew, heavily prosthetic.
Amazing.
You know, he's a really good performance.
Amazing.
But there's a round two is going to be, as you say, Emily's the executive producer of this. Is Amazon are doing a three-parter.
Who's playing Emily in that one, do you know?
It's Ruth Wilson.
Right.
So I think might be nearer the mark. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, Gillian Anderson's an amazing actress. Obviously.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm a big fan of Gillian Anderson.
There was something weird about the way she poshed Emily up a bit, didn't she?
The way they'd written it was as a kind of class warfare.
Yeah, but Emily, she's not...
That's not her.
For clarity, I don't know Emily. I've met her a couple of times. But she's not a class...
Not at all.
She's not upper class or anything. I think she went to a state school.
And she's not... I mean, that's just
There's no side to her. She's just, very natural.
She's just not like that.
They got her wrong, I think.
I think they wanted... But I think what they wanted to do is in the effort to correctly present Sam McAllister as, you know, the hero of the... Yeah. You know, getting the
uppity kind of scrappy.
They too crudely... contrasted her with the rest of the Newsnight team as a bunch of middle class liberals who portrayed Emily as a kind of, you know, glacial ice maiden, you know, prowling the corridors of New Broadcasting House in a sort of imperious way. That is so not right.
Is that bloody whippet thing true though? Did she walk around with a dog?
Well, she's always got the whippet with her.
Really?
She and Evan Davis, Radio 4.
Bring their dogs into work.
They are big whippet. I don't know. I mean, I have no idea whether the dogs go into work, but, you know, there is often...
I wouldn't have that.
A whippet.
Just for the record. Anyone applying for jobs in Europe, don't bring your dog.
But it wasn't, you know, it was sort of presented as like the Queen with corgis.
That's right.
You know, it's ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, she's a dog owner, right? Yeah. Who loves her whippet, and that's it.
Yeah. I did enjoy the show, though. I thought it was very well done.
It's a good watch. I just feel that, you know, it was...
I watched it for... So I watched the show, and then obviously there's a sort of curtailed version of the... Like a replica of the interview.
Interview, yeah.
And I was sitting there thinking that he can't have been that bad. And then I watched the full actual...
The actual one, and
it's exactly as bad.
Yes.
It's unbelievable to watch it again.
I mean, they you know, I don't think they show this in the film, but after, he really did think it had gone brilliantly.
Yeah.
And he said to the Newsnight team, Well, it's whatever night of the week it was. It's movie night, you know, yeah. And the family get together.
It was
the
Saturday night, I think. Yeah, wasn't it?
Well, that was when it was shown, but when it was recorded, was movie night, whatever movie house is in Buckingham Palace, and they show, you know, The Crown or whatever. Yeah. I don't know what the fuck they show. Yeah. But and he said, well, you know, do you want to hang around and, you know, with us and watch a movie? You know, and I think, you know, you're sitting there with the Queen, and I just love this idea of thinking it was so brilliant that you'd want to hang out.
Yeah.
And of course, they made their excuses and left because there was this terror that at some point someone would clock the fact that it had been an almighty disaster.
He is an appalling person by all accounts. I mean, and I'm not just talking about obviously his relationship with paedophiles and stuff like this, but I don't know whether you remember, but the Daily Mirror had, I can't remember what year it was, and there is an injunction against anybody discussing this. So I'm breaching an injunction from Buckingham Palace via the courts as we speak. However, I don't think anyone is going to rush us. But we had a reporter had applied for a job as butler to the Queen. Right, it was advertised. I was in charge of the investigation at the time. So Ryan Parry was the reporter and got the job. I mean, we must tell it in full. It's in the most extraordinary. I should write a bloody screenplay for this.
Honestly. Yeah, I mean that would make a great.
It's a great story. But anyway,
docudrama,
including Buckingham Palace phoning a pub in Wales where Ryan had given us a reference, and someone saying, "Is Mike there?" And getting the wrong mic on the phone, and the guy in the pub saying, "Ryan, yeah, he's a really good lad," and that was the acceptance of the reference. Anyway, Ryan's then a butler for the royal family for 3 months. He's on the back of the coach and all of this business. I mean, a footman. Came out the night George W. Bush landed in the Marine 2 or whatever it's called, the helicopter came down in the
Marine 1, I think.
And Marine 1, yeah. And then we pulled him out that night and then ran this bombshell. You know,
I remember it well. It was an amazing story.
And it was presented as, I mean, there were two sides to it. One was the extraordinary domestic detail of the royals, including the Queen having her Rice Krispies in a Tupperware box and all of this business, and listening to an old Roberts Clockwork Radio and all of this.
Fantastic.
But also the security issue, the fact that we had so easily managed to plan this.
Yeah.
You know, incredible to think
incredible
about
story.
It. But the thing that always stuck with me was one of Ryan's jobs was to open the curtains in Prince Andrew's bedroom every morning, some like really late hour of the day, like 10 a.m. or something like that.
Oh, really? He's a late riser.
And Ryan would tell how he would tiptoe into the bedroom and Andrew would be asleep, surrounded, as was in
the
show, by
toys.
All these stupid little teddy bears and kangaroos and all of that, and would open the curtains and invariably be greeted with Prince Andrew going, "Fuck off!" like this. And Ryan said, I'm fucking off now, sir.
Off. How shall I fuck off, O Lord? You know?
And this was just how he deals with the staff. You know,
I thought
quite
that
an odious man.
That was well captured in the tantrum scene where he threw a tantrum about the way that the teddy bears had been.
That's right. Kangaroo.
And you know, that he was basically an overgrown toddler.
Totally, totally.
You know,
mummy's favourite son.
With no interest in the consequence of his friendship with Epstein at all, you know.
The weird thing is the line they seem to cut from Scoop, unless I've gone mad and missed it, was the most striking line of all, which is where he said, "Well, I'm too honourable," you know, which was his kind
I think you're right. That wasn't.
But this idea, I mean, honestly, when you go back and relive it, the iniquity of the fact that he's paid 12 million quid, but won't admit anything. He continues to deny the photograph, the relationship, the what's obviously gone on, you know, and it's still got to come out. There's so much scandal around Jeffrey Epstein that hasn't seen the light of day yet. But
I mean, the Epstein story, I completely agree with you. It is, I think we've seen but a small percentage of it so far.
Bill Clinton as well.
I mean, the flight manifests alone
are quite
something, you know.
Well, anyway, well worth watching.
Definitely. But, and, you know, if you, and look, I mean, you know, if you like the music enough, go and see Back to Black just for the fun of seeing it in a big, but be prepared to be disappointed by the performance.
By the way, one thing that ties our entire podcast together, and it's happy coincidence, was that Stephen Colbert had Gillian Anderson on his show, and then Emily Maitlis tweeted, "My God, I'm so psyched about this." And what she was really psyched about was the fact he'd read the McTaggart lecture, which I had read a report of, but I'd never seen Emily
deliver it. Yes. And so I did watch her.
It's very good, isn't
it? It's fantastic.
No, it's very good.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really good. But where it's brilliant is the core message about how journalists are defeating their own purpose by willingly being pressured and seeking equivalence in arguments that have no equivalence. Yes. You know,
no, I mean, without betraying any confidence, I mean, I know a lot of thought went into that. And passion and you know. So we'll see what Ruth Wilson... It's odd, isn't it, how things... I suppose we should expect it in the era of X and social media. But, you know, Frost Nixon happened quite a long time after the actual event. But things, the dramas now just are almost in real time, aren't they?
I mean, that went into production a couple of years ago.
Yes, yeah.
You know, it was almost the week after.
It really is. So, you know, this is the new normal, I think.
Yeah. Well, and if any TV producers out there want the inside scoop on how we had a butler at Buckingham Palace for 3 months, I am all ears.
And also the story of how the two mats started.
Yes.
And, you know, we could do that.
We could definitely do that. I feel like there's definitely...
We're available, you know, for weddings and bar mitzvahs.
90 minutes IMAX there. Absolutely. All day long. Okay, so get your questions in, please. Any feedback to twomatts@tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2matts@tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can message us there. And that is exactly what great old Ed did, who says, regarding our last episode, why would Kennedy be a problem for Biden? Wouldn't he just as likely, if not more likely, take votes from Trump's voter base? What do you reckon?
I don't think that's right. I mean, how much of a problem Kennedy is going to be is very much a sort of known unknown at the moment, because we don't know whether he's going to get on the ballot in lots of states. Yeah. But he has explicitly said to voters already that he'd prefer Trump to Biden.
Yeah. Which,
and he's got the Kennedy name, which is the big name in Democratic folklore. And the other thing about him, which I think is underappreciated, is that since 2016, in which Facebook helped deliver the presidency to Trump, and, you know, that we talked about that, like Russian interference and all that, both Facebook and Instagram have really, the algorithms have changed. So political content is very, very, very low.
Right.
And we know that TV in America is in massive decline. Podcasts,
yeah,
the long podcasts that are very American, especially Joe Rogan's, are, you know, one of the battleground states, as it were, right? Yeah. And RFK has done every single big podcast.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
So don't underestimate him.
All right. Okay? Well, you can get more answers to your questions on Sunday when our Q&A returns. And please remember our subscription offer. If you like this podcast, you will love the New European newspaper. Go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2matts. That's the number 2 MATTS. There's a link in the show notes, and you'll get that wonderful offer with the free James O'Brien book. Thank you, as ever, to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, with support from Ollie Peart. And until next week...
It's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.